Studios.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are trying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Decir unas palabras en español porque yo soy guatemalteca con mucho orgullo, primero que soy americana.
Yeah, that right there is Delia Ramirez getting a round of applause speaking Spanish in Mexico City. Delia Ramirez, who is a story unto herself, a member of the United States Congress, an anchor baby for illegal alien parents by her own version of her birth story. And when you translate the Spanish she chose to use, she finds her first loyalty as a member of the United States Congress is not to the United States of America. It is instead to the country of Guatemala. She declared that she is loyal first to Guatemala and second to the United States of America, even though she's serving in the United States Congress. Take a listen to what she said again. I know it's in Spanish. If anybody differs on the translation, I'd be glad to hear the naysayer call. I am a Guatemalan with much pride before I am an American. The words of a member of the United States Congress, only it gets worse than that. I'll tell you the details in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Tuesday. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our X poll in honor of the Honorable Member of Congress, Delia Ramirez, Democrat of Illinois. Should Congress expel members who declare that they are first loyal to a foreign country and only secondarily to the United States of America? I would answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. I mean, this is a woman who says, I am a proud Guatemalan before I am an American. Do you know who retweeted that comment? The Department of Homeland Security that sent it out, and they sent it out along with a quote from President Teddy Roosevelt about rejecting foreign loyalties. There is no room in this country for hyphenated Americanism. Americanism is a matter of the spirit and the soul. Our allegiance must be purely to the United States. We must unsparingly condemn any man who holds any other allegiance, President Teddy Roosevelt. You can find the X poll today at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. But I want to get back to the nitty-gritty details of Delia Ramirez because she claims that her parents are now U.S. citizens. I'll explain how that is possible, but she was born about 3 years before the United States Congress foolishly granted the amnesty of 1986. She was born in June of 83. Ronald Reagan, when he signed that bill, later called it the biggest single mistake that he had ever signed on to. But at the time of her birth, by her own account, her parents were illegal aliens. And they were intending that Delia Ramirez, now a member of Congress, would be their anchor baby. How did they do it? By her own account, mom was already pregnant. She kept that secret from the others she was traveling with, and she literally swam the Rio Grande River. So make no mistake, by Delia Ramirez's account, her mom came into this country illegally, not legally. Now, what has happened? Well, for decades, some of us have been arguing about birthright citizenship, that the folks who wrote the 14th Amendment meant it to apply to the children of American slaves who'd been freed after the Emancipation Proclamation and after the end of the Civil War. So, does it apply to somebody who's born to illegal alien parents? The answer to that is no. In fact, there's only one time that the United States Supreme Court has actually weighed in on this, and it is often used incorrectly by supporters of open birthright citizenship with no limits whatsoever. It is the case called Wong Kim Ark. Wong Kim Ark was an American citizen. He was born to Chinese national parents, and the case that he brought to say, I'm an American, had one important distinction from all the anchor babies you hear about today. It was that Wong Kim Ark was born to Chinese nationals who were living in the United States legally at the time of his birth. That is a gigantic difference, because that's where the phrase "subject to the jurisdiction thereof" was written into the 14th Amendment. And as you know, the folks who wrote that document were geniuses. The people who wrote the Constitution and the Declaration were geniuses too. Many, many geniuses running the country at that time. Not so very many these days. So what has happened since? Well, it's been thoroughly misinterpreted, saying anybody who happens to get into the United States legally or otherwise, their children will be American citizens. Well, President Trump ordered from this point going forward, he signed an executive order. It applied within 30 days of when he signed it. It did not apply retroactively. So don't anybody make the mistake that I'm suggesting that what President Trump has ordered applies retroactively to Delia Ramirez. All I'm saying is, at the point where she was born, a few months after her mom swam the Rio Grande River and, by her account, almost got swept away in the waters, was rescued by somebody she doesn't know, but managed to make it to the other side to get a better life for their kid. These are all worthy goals, just not if you do them illegally. President Trump said that from this point going forward, children born to illegal aliens are not citizens. Now, that's been challenged before the Supreme Court, and all the Supreme Court did was it blocked the lower federal courts and said you cannot issue nationwide injunctions against President Trump's order. His order will apply except in those individuals' jurisdictions where the courts are. Now, the Supreme Court is going to eventually have to hear this case, but they told the folks who are bringing the case, attorneys for illegal aliens and their family members, if you want to pursue this, go after it through a class action lawsuit if you want to challenge what President Trump is doing. And I think Trump is right. The Constitution only grants citizenship to children born and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Delia Ramirez was the child of an illegal alien mother and was not subject to the jurisdiction. Does that mean she's kicked out of Congress? It should, but it won't. She's effectively grandfathered in from the previous and incorrect interpretation of the Constitution. But imagine what we have now. A member of the U.S. Congress, born to illegal aliens, therefore not a citizen, now married to another illegal alien covered by the illegal DACA order that was issued by, who else? Barack Hussein Obama. And a woman who declares that her first allegiance is not to the country where she serves in the Congress. It is instead to a foreign country. And, you know, ironically enough, she's probably a citizen of Guatemala, because Guatemala recognizes that anybody born to a Guatemalan mother is, in fact, a Guatemalan citizen. So while she's probably not, by any interpretation of the 14th Amendment, an American, she is certainly a Guatemalan, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised that her first allegiance is there. And already, members of Congress like Andy Ogles from Tennessee are saying, denaturalize her, deport her, and kick her off the Homeland Security Committee. We know where her allegiances lie. I think that's absolutely right. To be in the U.S. Congress, you have to be an American citizen for at least 7 years. Delia Ramirez is not that. Welcome to Tuesday. It's a pleasure to be with you. Glad to get you your calls, too. And naysayers, go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next, right here. So you can't play.
Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
You know, I think that a thank you is in order for saving the Northwest from tilting at windmills. The thanks should go to President Donald Trump. Oregon and Washington have chased every lunatic energy scheme that comes. Energy like coal and nuclear. You can see the damage already done every time you open up your electric bill. Now Donald Trump has shut down offshore wind. He's done it nationwide, the latest crazy idea to come along. State officials in Oregon especially had decided to set aside 200,000 acres of ocean off the South Oregon coast for wind power exclusively. That would devastate commercial fishing and recreation. Consider what we already know about these offshore wind scams. Major energy companies have already decided that even with multi-billion dollar taxpayer subsidies, the windmills offshore don't make economic sense. And then you have the Vineyard Wind Project off Nantucket. It was brand spanking new when one of the turbines simply flew apart and the carbon fiber blade fragments contaminated local beaches up to 50 miles away. Now imagine that happening on the Oregon or Washington coast. No matter how much your personal politics make you hate the orange man, you can send your thank you notes to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Plan to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go first at 866-439-5277. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Here's my question. Is the DA, Nathan Vasquez, does he have a spine to bring charges against Leslie Barnes? Now, Leslie Barnes, as we have reported before, is now the former director of preschool and early learning for Multnomah County. She resigned last week after a state investigation, and then the real digging by Joanna Ho of Willamette Week found that Leslie Barnes had sent money, $833,494, to the preschool that she owned, even though she was in charge of preschool for Multnomah County, that served just nine kids. So about $92,000 to provide preschool for each child. In the wake of her resignation, questions remain about how Barnes could own a preschool identified by state auditors as wasteful while overseeing the county's universal preschool initiative. So here's my question for DA Vasquez. Number one, has she committed official misconduct? If you take a look at the definition of official misconduct, a public servant commits the crime of official misconduct in the first degree if, with intent to obtain a benefit, the public servant knowingly fails to perform a duty imposed on the public servant by law. If she directed that contract to that preschool that she owns, was she trying to obtain a benefit from the public treasury? Second would be theft by deception, because her preschool said, why, we're going to care for 67 kids. We're going to provide 67 children with preschool services. Then they only provided them for for nine kids, but still got paid for 67. Would you call that theft by deception? I certainly would. Now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to the Clackamas County Commissioners, and I'd love to talk to Ben West or any of the others who voted on this. Clackamas County Commissioners saw their top lawyer for the county submit her resignation on June 21st. She said she is leaving to pursue another opportunity. Well, guess what? Her contract said that if you decide to leave your contract early, you get paid anywhere from 1 month to 6 months of severance. Now, personally, if you leave in the middle of your contract, I'd give you the 30 days. I wouldn't give you the 6 months. You know what Clackamas County did? They gave her 1 year of salary, despite her agreement with the county that only calls for 30 days to 6 months, depending on the terms of her separation. So she decides to leave, and Clackamas County, ordinarily kind of conservative, gives her almost $253,000. almost, you know, at least twice as much as she should have got, probably 10 times as much. She should have received 30 days pay. She got 12 months pay instead. Doesn't make any sense. Love to hear what the county commission has to say about it. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. You know, I had them do it for me. It looks absolutely beautiful. I can say that, and I wouldn't say it if I hadn't done it. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Eric Beaver writes in, Lars, about the road diets you were talking about, you know, where they reduce the lanes on major streets, streets that the taxpayers have already paid for so they can create more congestion. Eric writes, this crap is already happening on the east side of the state. Years ago, we spent hundreds of millions of dollars making a four-lane highway from Interstate 84 through the town of Stanfield all the way to downtown Hermiston. We also made a four-lane highway through the city of Milton Freewater all the way to the state line and then on to Walla Walla. A few years back, the government, in their infinite wisdom, removed the four lanes through Stanfield and through Milton Freewater, reduced them to two lanes with a turn lane in the middle and ridiculous bike paths that almost nobody ever uses, and if they do use them, they don't pay one penny toward the highway that we drivers paid for. But of course, they have the right of way, and they are protected like the spandex mafia they are. Signed, Eric. Eric, thanks very much. Let me jump to one quick call, and that's Jay in Yakima. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Howdy, Lars. Hey, up here in Yakima. We had a little act of domestic terrorism against an ICE facility.
Yes, you did.
I'm just hearing about it. Yes. Oh, you heard about that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, we didn't even hear about it here in Yakima. I'm just reading about it, and I'm thinking,
the attack on the ICE office, right?
Correct. And they tried to set it on fire, and there were agents inside. So
that is domestic terrorism, and they should pursue the people involved in that, because
absolutely.
You know, if this is where we're going, that when you have the enforcement of laws in the United States, and by the way, I keep pointing this out, Jay, I think it's important to emphasize, these are not new laws. These laws were on the books a long time before Donald Trump ever even announced that he was running for president, which was about 10 years ago. And so the laws already on the books are being enforced, and so the response is that federal immigration agents escaped an arson attack on their office in Yakima over the weekend. A rock was thrown through the wall of the build, or through the building's window, and it's listed as a field office on the ICE website, and then they set a fire on the back of the property on Saturday. And so you've got acts of terrorism against ICE agents. I mean, even the liberals in the Northwest have to object to that, don't they?
Oh, I would think so. Absolutely. And I, you know, it's not limited to Portland. And heck, I lived in the Portland area for almost 30 years. So, you know, it's just, if it's Portland and Yakima, something's got to change here.
Yeah, something does have to change. Jay, thanks a lot. And thanks for listening on KONA. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. He does the work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I have to tell you something. Spokane is a wonderful city on the eastern side of Washington State. I lived there for almost a year once, enjoyed it immensely. And I hate to see the kind of things that are being done to that city by what passes for political leadership. But occasionally there are people with some common sense. And one of them is Jonathan Bingle, a member of the Spokane City Council, who joins me now. Councilmember Bingle, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
It sounds like you and I are probably on the same page when it comes to this idea of housing first to deal with homeless and drug addicts, and that Spokane, and it sounds like the voters of Spokane want to get away from it, but the political elites do not. They want to drag them to housing first, kicking and screaming all the way.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, the thing that's tough about it is that on its face, housing first sounds like really practical, but the problem is that Housing First became Housing Only pretty quickly, and then all we did is started transitioning the problems that we found on the streets. Instead of dealing with those underlying human issues, we just put them into housing throughout the city. We scattered it throughout the city, and now our neighborhoods are being dragged down by this awful policy.
Okay, so why is it that when the voters said we don't want it, then the courts strike that down, then the city council at least tried to impose it anyway, and that got struck down? What's holding you back, and who do we need? Whose names do we need to call out on this?
Yeah, so there's a supermajority on the current city council. I'm in a super minority with my seatmate, council member Michael Cathcart. And when the court struck down Proposition 1, which is what we call it, which are our anti-encampment measures, we tried to immediately bring it back because it was totally legal and possible for us to bring it back. And the council majority and the mayor decided they didn't want it, and so that failed. And now the voters are, you know, left here thinking, wait a minute, does our voice still matter?
Do any of them think this is actually working when you take a bunch of drug addicted people who are mostly on the streets because of drugs and alcohol and you put them in housing and then you just kind of cross your fingers and hope real hard that they manage to kick the habit now that they've got a comfortable place to continue to be addicted? Do any of them think that approach is actually working?
Well, they've become slaves to the experts, right? So the experts in homelessness will come into them and say, well, this is best practice. We absolutely must be doing this. And then they change it enough to say, no, it's going to work this time because we're doing this instead. And the problem is that all we have are these, you know, failed experiments all throughout the city of Spokane, and not just throughout Spokane, but throughout the West Coast, from people coming in and saying, trust us, these are best practices. And they do fall into that lie. Unfortunately, the majority of my city just doesn't trust these people anymore and is looking for something different.
By the way, when you have these so-called experts, do most of them work for and draw a paycheck from the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that the city shovels out money to?
Almost exclusively, they work for these organizations, yes. And, I mean, homelessness is big business, right? The city of Spokane alone, from state grants and federal grants and our own money, we spend about $40 million a year on homelessness when our entire general fund is only about $260 million. And so it's a pretty significant amount of money that we're shelling out.
So Jonathan, is anybody willing to, you know, break political correctness and say to these jokers, hey, you're getting a paycheck. As long as there continue to be drug addicts living on the streets, your paycheck continues. The minute this problem is solved by doing something different than the same thing that's been done for about the last 12 years, you're out of a job. You've got a conflict of interest. Why should we believe you?
There are serious conflicts of interest there. And not only that, but if you look at the movement from NGO to then working for the city, back to the NGO and back to working for the city, there's a bit of an incestuous relationship that just continues to perpetuate these contracts in a way that I think is improper. And the taxpayer is now starting to wake up, thankfully, and say, wait a minute, this just isn't working. Can somebody please offer a different vision for how to get us out of this?
Okay,
and that's
because,
what I'm hoping to bring to the city.
Because, Jonathan, one of the things I keep pointing out, I'll bet you know this already, this whole idea came from Barack Obama 12 years ago. And he said 12 years ago in 2013, he said, we're going to go to Housing First. If you don't subscribe to Housing First, you don't get the HUD money. Spokane gets HUD money. Portland, all the other cities get housing and urban development money. You don't get the money unless you go Housing First. We will solve the problem in 10 years. That's what Hussein Obama said 12 years ago. And the problem is three times as big today as it was 12 years ago.
Yeah, there's a commensurate rise in homelessness with the rise of dollars being spent on this failed strategy. And again, the problem is that Housing First sounded like a good idea to many, but it became Housing Only. And the problem is that when you have drug addict and severely mentally ill individuals, just giving them housing is not going to solve the underlying issue. And again, we're left here holding the bag of that failed policy.
Although the thing I'm always tempted to ask people, I'm talking to council member Jonathan Bingle from the city of Spokane, is if you had a family member who was a drunk or a drug addict and they said, will you take me in? And you agreed to take them in. Would any sane person say, go ahead, move into the back bedroom of our house and keep on shooting all the heroin you want to? Would anybody on your city council do that?
You know, we ask that question all the time, which is, you know, why don't you put this shelter right next to your house and see how you feel about it? But that will obviously never happen. Now, I represent Spokane's poorest district, the Northeast, and we often get these things shoved down our throat and shoved into our district because property values are lower, and then it just snowballs out of control to where we're left, again, with a significant number of crime and drug issues up in the area that I represent because nobody wants it in their backyard, but they feel totally fine putting it next to the people they're supposedly standing up for, you know, the poor, the historically neglected, and it just doesn't make any sense.
All right, so what's it going to take to break this logjam? Or do we just keep doing this and they say we're being compassionate by letting these people kill themselves with fentanyl or heroin or alcohol?
Yeah, it's going to take a legitimate alternative to helping people who are broken. And I think Trump's executive order got to the heart of the issue, which is we have severe addiction issues in our cities up and down the West Coast and throughout the country. And we have severe mental health issues that must be addressed. And currently we don't have the infrastructure to address long-term stays for folks in those positions. But I think that's the direction the federal government is going to be heading. And I think it's a good one. And I hope that we partner with the federal government as opposed to opposing anything Trump does.
Well, how about this? The 30 tiny homes that they want to put up in the West Hills neighborhood of Spokane. If you said you get one of these tiny homes, but you need to start quitting drugs, you can fall off the wagon, say three strikes. On the third strike, you're out. Hard set of rules. You can, you know, we'll give you up to three strikes. And after that, you're out and we'll give it to somebody who's actually trying to get off drugs. If you approached it that way, would that make a difference?
I love this idea because I'm a former pastor. The church is a come-as-you-are organization. It's sick people who need a doctor, not the healthy people. So I want people to come. But the problem with housing first is that it doesn't allow you to establish what they call barriers. And until that changes, this model will continue to fail. And so if the federal government, if HUD reformed itself and allowed us to do something other than housing first, I think you would see a lot of successful models like this because then we could say, hey, if you're breaking these rules, you're out of here. And that accountability will lead people to the promised land, really.
Okay, as you understand Trump's executive order, will Spokane still get the HUD money, even though it's continuing to pursue housing first?
I don't think that the elected leadership in Spokane is afraid enough of the executive order. I don't think it understands. I don't think that we as a city understand the real threat that that is and how Trump has, in my opinion, every inclination to follow through on his word. And so I think that it's going to take a real removal of those dollars first for us to wake up and then change our ways. I hope that we don't have to go through that, but we'll see.
Well, I got to tell you something. It's not compassionate at all to leave people in that kind of situation and just say, yeah, we know this is probably going to kill all of them, but that's okay. They'll die happy on fentanyl or heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine or a bottle of booze. Jonathan, thanks so much. We'll have you back.
Thanks, Lars. Appreciate it.
That is Jonathan Bingle. He is member of the Spokane City Council, part of a very small minority on the council. I'll be back to you in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And then we'll tell you about the major foobar that has happened involving Oregon's PERS system and why it's costing your kids.
Town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. This segment of the show brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Let me go first to Rick in Terrebonne. Hey, Rick, welcome to the Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, this redistricting thing, these Democrats in Texas are patting themselves on the back. Well, when they did it here in Oregon, they gave us in Jefferson County, we voted for Chavez Dreamer. She won.
Yep.
Well, 4 years later, they just moved the line just a little tiny bit, and guess who wins? Bynum.
Yep.
How come nobody's talking about what they did to us over here?
Do you know why? And I'll tell you, it's funny because I heard an interview on our flagship station, KXL, this morning, in Portland, and they were talking to their political expert, and they said, so what does this mean, what's happening in Texas here in Oregon? He says, oh, Oregon's already gerrymandered to a fare thee well, or words to that effect. Basically, the whole state has been gerrymandered to death by the Democrats. Why? Because they have a supermajority in the House, a supermajority in the Senate. They have every single statewide elected office is a Democrat. They, all the major players in the biggest city councils and county commissioners, commissions are all Democrats. The whole state is owned by the Democrats right now, I think in large part because of the failed and flawed vote by mail system. But for whatever reason, they've already gerrymandered the whole state, and the Republicans have almost no say whatsoever in how the state's lines are redrawn. The Democrats hold all the cards in that case. So if you wonder, why is it they get everything they want? Because they write the lines. And do the Republicans have any ability to push back at all? And the answer is they don't. And even in Texas, they don't. The Democrats are a minority in that state. And the only way they can shut down the redistricting is by physically leaving the state. So they got on a very expensive chartered jet. And they took off, and most of them went to Chicago, Illinois. So the reason it's not being talked about here, because redistricting in both Oregon and Washington is, well, Washington's a little different. Washington has a different system for redrawing the lines, and I think it's actually a superior system, but it's a tough call. And the folks who wrote into the Constitution that you had to redraw all those lines every time there's a census and every time the numbers change, you know, because when you recount a state, if a state gets a lot more population, another state loses population, the state that lost population loses a member of Congress, and the state that gained population gains one, but then you have to redraw the lines so that each one of the members of Congress represents, these days, it's about 800,000 Americans in every congressional district. And then all of a sudden the Democrats, if you've seen some of the maps out of Texas, it's insane. I mean, you're there in Terrebonne. I think one of the districts, actually, it hops the Cascade Mountains, does it not? It starts in Clackamas County and then comes up and over the mountains to Bend, I believe. I don't have these things committed to memory, but they draw some crazy district lines, and they do it entirely for what you said. Change the lines, you win that district. Let's go to Jack. Hey, Jack, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm wondering, why won't anybody show the video of the Jewish guy digging his own grave that's so super skinny? I mean, it seems to me, if they put that out there, maybe some people would get on their side. But
I talked about it yesterday, Jack. I did. I mean, I'm in radio, so I don't deal as much in pictures, but we put stuff on the website. I can't remember if I retweeted that one, but you're right. Just to give people an idea of what Jack's describing, there is a man who's standing there. He has been starved by Hamas for the last 2 years. So imagine getting inadequate food for 2 years. He's almost 2 years. It'll be 2 years as of October 7th. He was one of the people taken hostage. He is skin and bones. He's like death camp skinny. And he's standing in a tunnel. And he's been told to dig his own grave. And Hamas shot the video. So what he said in there was with the approval of Hamas. So these terrorists have told him, you've been starved for 2 years. You're not going to be around that much longer. Dig your own grave in this tunnel in the dark. And can you imagine being in that position? And you're right. Most of the major media should be running this on every single channel, on every single network, because you just take a look at that. If you weren't already convinced when the slaughter happened on October 7th, and then later when you heard documented reports that young ladies had been raped, that children had been killed, children were taken hostage and held hostage, you would think the whole world would be lined up against Hamas. And instead, you've got all the Democrats side with Hamas. All the universities have sided with Hamas. All of the networks, all they can say is, oh, those evil Jews, how dare they do what they're doing? And it's shameful. And the idea that a group, a terrorist organization, could torture a man by starving him to death and then make him dig his own grave. And yet, like you said, if you don't show that to people, they may not believe that it's happening. But it is happening. And when somebody says, oh, that's made up, Hamas put the video together. Hamas released the video. It's the major networks that don't want to show it.
So what's your gut feel? Just take, you know, I hate to put you
my
on
gut
top,
feel.
Why won't
I think Israel has finally reached the end of its road, and they're going to go in and slaughter the Hamas terrorists, and they deserve it. They should wipe out every last one of them.
Why won't the media show this video, though? I mean, because Fox News is talking about it constantly, but they
because,
won't show it.
Because they take, I don't know why they won't show it. I mean, the man has a pair of pants on. He looks like he's skin and bones at this point. And again, the horrific idea that a guy starved for 2 years and kept from his family and friends is now being told, dig your own grave. I don't know why they won't show it. It's
the Lars Larson.
This is not a joke.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back, Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. Always glad to get to your calls, and I'll do that in just a moment. So if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. As always, naysayers go to the head of the line. If you've got, the backbone or whatever parts of your anatomy that you need to have to make an argument against what you're hearing, we welcome that. We want you to make your best argument. I mean, usually naysayers end up being kind of pathetic, but hey, we're glad to let you have the soapbox for a change. Now, I've invited Dr. Eric Fruits to my soapbox. He is Vice President of Research at Cascade Policy Institute. Dr. Fruits, welcome, and tell me, is Oregon on its way to being, a future as the Appalachia of the West Coast?
No. Yes, for years I've said that. In some ways, Oregon is the West Virginia of the West Coast because we seem to be so reliant on natural resources until we got rid of them. And we didn't have a very good education system. And now it looks like West Virginia is actually doing better than Oregon. So it really is.
In education, West Virginia, notoriously bad for education, is better than Oregon at this point.
Well, when you're at the bottom, there's not much further to go other than up, and we're almost at the bottom.
Well, and one of the things I worry about, because I get people who say all the time, Lars, if you don't like the West Coast, you know, leave. And I say, no, it's not that I don't like it, but it's like anything else where you want to see things improve, and all I see lately is degradation. And some of the examples are things like, you know, the signature building in downtown Portland, Big Pink, was sold 10 years ago for about $9 million a floor. It got fire sailed for about $1 million a floor just within the last few weeks. The Ritz-Carlton Hotel, brand spanking new with condos and all that, and it's in bankruptcy. And you've got Intel saying, we're not sure, you know, what our future is here in the Silicon Forest. And then you've got the folks at Nordstrom, Northwest Company, saying, you know, we're not sure to the mayor, Mayor Wilson, how much longer we're going to have a store able to operate in downtown Portland. And you put all that on top of the homelessness and the drug addiction and the filth and the degradation and the depolicing and everything else. And you wonder, where is this going and how do we stop the slide downhill?
Well, that's right. And, you know, I moved up here 20 years ago, and I'm sure you and I have a lot to say about Vera Katz. But with hindsight, the Vera Katz era was almost a golden age, right? We were every paper and magazine said that we were the most livable place in the country, most livable place in the world. And then we just kind of like, it's like a stick that you just kind of whittle down to a toothpick. And I think that's what happened. Is it's been just 20 years of just whittling down and neglect that has taken us here. And it's a real shame. And the problem is, you know, we keep electing people who just aren't serious people. They just want to have blue ribbon commissions and do some PowerPoints, but they never actually want to get the boots on the ground to actually make things better. And my real worry is, and you see it around you, is that people said, you know what? The ballot box isn't working. I'm just going to put on my shoes and I'm going to leave. You know, Clark County is looking really good right now.
Well, and if not Clark County, then maybe over to Idaho, because doesn't Portland now rank as a city the second highest taxing jurisdiction in America after New York City? I think I saw that number not long ago.
I think so. And I think if you count things in different ways, we may actually be the top. I mean, and this is not one of those places where you want to be number one, right? You don't want to be number one in tax burden. And especially on higher income individuals, right? Those are the people who are leaving. And those are the people who bring in the tax revenues. But they're also the people who get involved in the community. They're the ones who serve on nonprofit boards. They're the ones who are involved in civic projects. And, you know, when they go away, you lose that. I mean, if you go back again to the 20 years ago, right, you saw people, organizations like Geldwin, you know, being really active in the community. They're gone, right? And that money never came back.
No, they never did. And I wonder about some of the other biggies. You've got Gert Boyle and Tim Boyle, late Gert Boyle and Tim Boyle, you know, who are probably the only reason Columbia Sportswear is in the Northwest. Nike has a big physical infrastructure out in Beaverton, but, you know, they stayed in Oregon primarily because of Phil Knight. Phil Knight is now, you know, out of the company for the largest part, still the largest stockholder. But you wonder, how long do these companies stick around when those familial ties go away?
Well, you've got that, and then you've got Intel, where, you know, we have a huge presence in Oregon. But the thing is, they're not an Oregon company. There's some guy in California with a spreadsheet who's probably looking at that spreadsheet every day and saying, huh, are these numbers actually adding up? You know, we're, you know, there's rumors, you know, you've already had a huge number of layoffs at Intel. There's rumors that there's going to be even more coming that haven't been announced yet. That is just going to, that's going to drag down Washington County, and it's going to drag down the state. And once those highly paid engineers pack up their U-Hauls, they're probably not coming back either.
No, and the other thing about that business, Dr. Fruits, and tell me I'm wrong, is that about every 3 or 4 years, if that long, they have to rebuild those fabs. But they, for the most part, build them from the ground up. You know, they don't just go in and fix a thing or two here and there like most industrial plants. They basically build a brand new fab for the newest, latest edition of chips. Well, they can build the fab anywhere they want to build it. It's not necessarily tied geographically to the Northwest. So they could say, gee, down in Texas we can get permits, or down in Georgia or some other state, we'll get, we have the energy available, we have the trained workforce, we've got the smart folks, and we can build that fab anywhere we want. We don't have to build it in hyper-expensive Hillsboro with hyper-regulated Oregon.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, part of it is if you own a company like that, and you could just walk down the city hall and say, I need a permit to build a fab. And they say, sure, what do you need? And then they sign it, you know, within a couple of weeks. That's a lot different from Oregon, where, you know, you end up having, you know, the 1,000 Friends of Oregon and all these other people saying, oh, gee, we really can't expand this here. We got to preserve all this wonderful land that no one's sitting on. You know, eventually you just say, well, you know what? There's a lot of nice places in this country that have room. And that's where you'll go, right? And I think that's one of the biggest lies we tell ourselves, is that we think that Oregon is such this wonderful place of natural beauty without recognizing that there are huge portions of the United States that have wonderful natural beauty without all the baggage that comes with it.
No, and I think what's happened is Oregon is a beautiful place. So is Washington State, a beautiful place. But if you let the regulators come in and the taxers and the spenders, and you say, we're going to spend ourselves into oblivion. Oregon's done that. It's broke, you know, and ODOT is broke, so you can't get around. Washington State just passed the biggest tax increase in history, and they immediately announced, we're broke again, so we're going to have to raise taxes again. At some point, the big players like that are going to say, then we're headed for the exit door. That's Dr. Eric Fruits, who's Vice President of Research at Cascade Policy Institute. Back in a moment, I'll get you your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. We'll talk about Russiagate and the new grand jury coming up next. Hey there, it's...
unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails. Do you know that a federal grand jury has been ordered by the Attorney General, that's Pam Bondi, to investigate allegations surrounding the Russiagate narrative, specifically focusing on claims that the Obama administration and intelligence officials manipulated information to damage the Trump campaign. This is the first step. Now, I understand if you're skeptical and you say all of this will come to nothing. I don't think that's the case. I mean, I don't think that the Attorney General is going to put herself in a position where she says, I've got a grand jury. They're going to listen to all the evidence. And I want to talk about some of that and what we know now. And I also want to talk about what Americans think about the whole Russiagate mess. Well, the fact is Americans are pretty united on it. They want somebody to go to jail for this. And I'll give you my proof in just a moment. First, welcome to the program. We call this the best conversation in talk journalism, and it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, and we get naysayers all the time, I made the decision more than 25 years ago. I said, you know, when people call the show and they disagree, on a lot of talk shows, you call in, you get screened out by the screeners. Not with my producers, not with Donovan, not with Joel, and certainly not with McKenzie. If you call in and say, Lars is completely wrong about this, great. You get to go to the head of the line. Just be prepared with your best argument, maybe a little bit of evidence, some facts and logic, that sort of thing will help you out a lot. But naysayers go to the head of the line. Our X poll question today, should Congress expel members who declare their first loyalty is not to America? I would answer that one. Yes, you can answer it any way you like. I'm talking specifically this time about Illinois Democrat Representative Delia Ramirez. Delia Ramirez is a member of Congress. She is also an anchor baby. She had illegal alien parents who came to America. She was born in America about 3 years before the Reagan amnesty. She now says that her parents are now citizens. I suspect that they are now citizens because mom and dad came in illegally. She was born, and under what I think is the correct interpretation of the 14th Amendment, she's not an American citizen. Now, Donald Trump is fighting the good fight when it comes to birthright citizenship. And most of what comes out of that fight, and I'm fairly confident that when the Supreme Court finally decides this one, they're going to decide the 14th Amendment says if you were born in America to parents who were legally in America, you are an American. If you were born in America to parents who are not here legally, like Delia Ramirez's parents, then you're not an American citizen. So, what did she do? She went to a conference in Mexico City, and she stood up and in Spanish gave the message, I am a proud Guatemalan before I'm an American. That's what she said in Spanish. We've seen multiple translations of this. So you've got a member of the U.S. Congress, member of the Democrat Party, who declares that she is a proud Guatemalan before she's an American. Now, she's tried to make this sound like it's just like Americans who say, I've got Irish blood, or I'm Scottish, or I'm English, or I'm German, or I'm Russian, or I'm Chinese. Problem is, that's not what she said. I am a proud Guatemalan before I am an American. So her loyalties do not lie to the in this country. In fact, if you look at how she was born and where she was born to Guatemalan parents. If you check, and I did this morning, you check the law, Guatemalan will call you a Guatemalan citizen if you were born to Guatemalan parents. She was the child of illegal aliens, which means she is not an American. And she is a Guatemalan. Now, does that work legally against her? No, probably not. I'm just telling you, this is somebody who the Democrat Party chose as its nominee to run for the United States Congress to represent Americans. And she represents people in Illinois who may not have realized before that her first loyalties are not with those people in Illinois. They are with people in Guatemala. Because she sees, apparently, her genetic heritage, her family connections to Guatemala, that comes first. Being an American comes second. Now, if you think that that's a good way to represent people in America, then you probably voted Democrat. But let me get back to this grand jury probe, because for the longest time, a lot of us have said, just put all this stuff in front of a grand jury and ask the grand jury, do you believe that people like James Clapper and Mr. Brennan and Mr. Obama. He could be an unindicted conspirator. As a result of being president, he is likely immune from any kind of actual prosecution. But prosecute McCabe, prosecute Hillary Clinton, prosecute the rest of these jokers. What happens when you ask Americans, do you think there ought to be criminal consequences for what happened in the Russiagate hoax? And the short version of that hoax goes this way. Hillary Clinton knew that she couldn't win the presidency running against Donald Trump. In fact, I'd venture to say Hillary Clinton could win the presidency running against almost anybody. The woman is a terrible campaigner. She has almost no personal charm. I mean, her husband, the horny hick from Arkansas, Bill Clinton, could charm the paint right off the wall. But his wife is stiff and brittle and kind of nasty. And, of course, a lot of people point out that they have an awful lot of friends and associates who've ended up dead by suicide mysteriously over the year. So that's another reason to stay away from them. But when the Rasmussen report went out and they said, what do you think ought to happen for the deeds that were done during the Russia collusion hoax? Two-thirds of likely voters say there must be consequences for the crimes committed in that scandal. Now, why are we asking this question now? Because the new documents that have come out in the last 2 weeks show the Obama White House and players within the deep state were involved in the Russia collusion hoax. This wasn't just something cooked up by Hillary Clinton, funded by Clinton's campaign and the DNC, money funneled through the law firm of Perkins Coie to a company called Fusion GPS, who then hired a retired secret agent from Great Britain, Christopher Steele, who came up with a Steele dossier, a big pile of garbage that it was entirely untrue. But they said, we're going to convince Americans that Donald Trump is in the pocket of Vladimir Putin and Russia. Well, that turned out not to be true. Investigated not once, not twice, but several times. And it turns out there was no truth to that. Was it all cooked up by Hillary Clinton? Yep. Do we now know for a fact that Barack Hussein Obama knew about that hoax, knew that it was untrue? Yes, he knew. And he knew that it was untrue. That's what the most recent document releases have shown. What did he direct the FBI and the CIA to do? He directed them to go out and come up with other documentation to back up the Russia collusion hoax. In other words, Obama was going to help Hillary. I think she might have figured that he owed her. Two-thirds, 69% of likely voters in that Rasmussen Report poll say there must be consequences for the crimes committed in the Russiagate scandal. That's a powerful number. I mean, that means it must be just about every single conservative, plus almost all the independent voters and a certain percentage of Democrats. The poll asked, do you agree or disagree with this statement about the manipulation of intelligence in the Obama administration? Accountability has to take place. It is critical for the survival of our country that people who perpetrate such crimes are held accountable. And 54%, slightly smaller but still a majority, believe is likely that members of Obama's national security team, quote, committed crimes when they manipulated and manufactured intelligence to promote a false narrative about Russia and President Donald Trump. Yeah, pretty clear. Americans want somebody to go to jail, and now there's a grand jury to hear the evidence, and that's a good thing. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. You can literally have Lars with you all day, every day. Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You realize that the Democrat Party has to have double standards, because if they didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards whatsoever. But consider this. every single state in America has to redraw congressional boundaries every time there's a census. In fact, some of the states even have limitations that say you can't even do a midterm that is halfway between one census and the next census. You can't go in and redraw the district lines. New Jersey is one of those states with that kind of limitation. But now in Texas, where Republicans have the majority and the Democrats are in the minority, you literally had Democrat members run from the state of Texas and flee off to Illinois, a thoroughly gerrymandered state, to say, we don't want them to redistrict the state. I thought we'd talk about that with Jack Lombardi, who is a tech entrepreneur and former Republican candidate for Congress in Florida's 19th district. Mr. Lombardi, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you, Lars. Thank you for having me. Man, this guy, he does anything he can to get a headline, even break the law. This isn't federalism. I mean, it's honestly, Lars, they claim they're protected democracy while violating and diverting democracy. It's just, it's mind-blowing. It's like him and Slick, I'm sorry, that's what I call him, Governor Newsom, are in a race to the bottom to see who can have the most communist, I'm sorry, social democratic, what are we calling it? Democratic socialism stance on how we can go and rip up the U.S. Constitution or even state constitution. Listen, I've come to the conclusion there's not a law that Democrats can't break. However, they're going to be the one that are first going to say we need another new law and not enforce the ones we have if it works for their agenda. It's absolutely crazy. And one other thing is, when I ran for Congress against your favorite congressman, Adam Kinzinger, remember that guy? I heard your favorite guy. What they're saying on the street. So, Lars, what happened is, I'm in a boot today. I warned the booker today. So here's what happened. They drew me, remember, because I'm from Illinois, originally from the infamous Cook County.
Yep.
They drew my house out of the district. If you look at where I lived and where they drew the line,
they drew it right down the street and said, Jack's out.
580 feet. I could see the road. I said, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me. And you know where they put me? They put me in the first district because I moved away from the city area that was becoming undesirable. It was a great area to grow up in. I'm so grateful my mom and dad put me in such a nice area where we didn't get shot. We only got stabbed, but that's irrelevant. So what happened is we moved away when my son was going to high school. We all got on board and we moved into a nice little town called Manhattan, Illinois, which is a nice little farm town. And they drew that into the first congressional district, which goes all the way to the south side, you know, the one you see on the news where everyone's getting shot. Yep. They drew that together, knowing that all the people that were in Manhattan, Illinois, New Lenox, Frankfort, all affluent areas, middle class, upper middle class areas, had a snowball's chance in hell to push through any legislation that applied to them because it was connected to the south side, where, you know, they could play all the voting games, allegedly, of course, right? Because we can't say that they actually, you know, rigged them or used multiple names in the same block and had people harvesting them and having
more than, walking around money or any of that good stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't happen. I mean, come on. Yeah, yeah, right. So that is the game that they're playing. And now, so if you remember, Lars, and I'm sure you do, this is not the first time that these Texas legislators tried to game the system while they were protecting democracy at the same time as they're diverting democracy. It's just, again, funny to me. So this is not the first time. Now they run to Illinois into the arms of J.B. Pritzker that's going to, you know, be a sanctuary state for lawbreakers that are lawmakers. It's just mind-blowing to me. The audacity, and then he's going to go on and say these things about gerrymandering after I just explained, you know, how brutally corrupt Illinois is in their gerrymandering process.
Well, like you said, Gavin Newsom is saying, here, draw up a brand new map, put it in front of the voters, and we'll do a November special election. We'll fix it that way. Why is it that in all the bluest states, when they, you know, redraw the districts, and if they've got the majority in a blue state, they voted through, and you don't see the Republicans run out of town to block that move the way the Democrats are running out of town in Texas? And what do they expect to do other than simply delay the process? They're not going to change anything, are they?
Well, you know, here's what's really interesting. So first part, you know, Republicans have this little problem. It's called integrity, right? And yeah. I'm not saying that all Republicans
do. It's true.
I ran again. But many of them, most of us that identify as Republican, you know, we're not always happy with the party, but at least we honor integrity and we honor the rule of law. It doesn't mean we always have to agree with it, but we'll honor it and take the appropriate channels. Democrats, they'll say, hey, we're protected democracy, and they'll divert it at the same time. I feel like a broken record, but there's no other way to really say it. And then the second part here is, what are they trying to do? Well, you know, listen, they're getting their can kicked. They know this. Overwhelmingly, Americans said, we're done with the Democrats. We're done with the new Democrats. A lot of them, you know, have walked away realizing that their Democratic Party, you know, in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, has left them. And now it's this democratic socialism, communist light crap that they're doing.
The squad.
And Americans,
right?
Yeah. It, you know, it's posh. It's, you know, it's cool. It sounds cool to be in a restaurant with all the new lights and everything in New York City and all these, you know, big cities like Chicago and everything. But the reality is it sucks. Okay. It's not good for anybody but big business and the puppeteers that finance these criminals and low IQ crooks that they have over there in the Democratic Party that's leading it right now. And, you know, I feel bad because I know I personally have met a handful of Democrats, believe it or not. They actually love the country, but they got such a problem right now in their party, and they have lost control of these lunatics, you know, Illinois
well,
and California
think about
being
this,
the worst.
Jack, you've got Hope Pocahontas, right, Elizabeth Warren, who comes out and says, yeah, this Zohran Mamdani, the DSA, not the DNC, but the DSA candidate for mayor of New York, who may end up as mayor of New York, he's the face of the new Democrat Party. Do you know how if you thought they've sunk down now in the public ratings, how do you suppose they're going to do when the new socialist slash communist mayor of New York City is declared the new mayor or the new face of the Democrat Party? Americans are going to run away from that party, aren't they?
Lars, I was just, you know, I box 4 days a week. There's a guy that I met in the gym. He has a shirt that says, I hate communists. I'm like, this is going to be my friend right here. I just got to make the introduction. And so a friend actually that happens to go to the same boxing gym made that introduction. We get talking, and then my friend said, you know, how involved I've been in politics because I'm not smart. And so he had a lot of questions for me. And one of the things was this radical nut job here in New York that, you know, may actually be the mayor. And I had explained kind of how it works, you know, how it's he's still got to have a whole city board to get on par. And, you know, it's tricky. And then I left him with this. I said, now, if we start seeing U.S. senators say this stuff, then we need to be really concerned because they're the people who have the power to pass the laws to implement a lot of this policy. A mayor, you know, I mean, they could do local stuff and they're kind of limited by a whole board. But when you see a senator, U.S. senator, then that draws caution. And I kid you not, last night I saw that, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
No, because because Pocahontas is saying that. Everybody else is staying silent. I don't think they want to condemn what Mamdani says he stands for. But if she's embracing it and they're staying silent, we know which direction they're going. That's Jack Lombardi, who's a tech entrepreneur and former Republican candidate for Congress in Florida's 19th district. Back in a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. And would you allow state lawmakers to destroy their... I can certainly...
He's up before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday, live on the Radio Northwest Network, which serves the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We provide honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. Go to NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles. You pick the closing date. Find the details at NickShivers.com. Now, our X poll today goes this way. Should Congress expel any member who declares their first loyalty is to another country and not America? Who am I describing? Democratic Representative Delia Ramirez, a Democrat of Illinois, went to Mexico. She went to Mexico City. She was appearing at a conference. She spoke in Spanish, and she said, in Spanish, I am a proud Guatemalan before I am an American. Now, do you think that's the proper sentiment of somebody who represents people in the state of Illinois? I don't think so. The Department of Homeland Security wants citizens to see her confession of foreign loyalty. They immediately tweeted out what she had said, and then they put in the quote from President Teddy Roosevelt, who said, there is no room in this country for hyphenated Americanism. Americanism is a matter of spirit and the soul. Our allegiance must be purely to the United States. We must unsparingly condemn any man who holds any other allegiance, and I'm sure that President Roosevelt meant women as well. The ex-poll, should Congress expel members who declare their first loyalty is not to America? I would answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, yesterday's poll question, should lawmakers who flee their state, that's the Democrats from Texas, to avoid lawmaking votes, should they be expelled from office? 79% of you said yes. 21% of you said no. And as far as I can tell, all they're doing is delaying the process. Every single state has to write new congressional boundaries for its state after the last census. That is what Texas is doing right now. Did the people who wrote that into the Constitution, did they actually expect that this would be a political decision? They knew that it would be a political decision because it was a decision that was going to be made by politicians. And they knew that some of them would be liberal, some of them would be conservative. And if the conservatives were in the majority, you're going to get some conservative district lines. What the Democrats who fled from Texas have not done is pointed out why the way that the lines were drawn is in any way not in keeping with the Constitution or the law. They're not trying to make that argument. They're just saying they don't like the result because it's going to result in more conservative members of the U.S. Congress and fewer liberals. And the Democrats already realize, as you've heard from a number of guests on this show even today, that the Democrats are in big trouble. Their approval ratings are around 20% with Americans. Approval for what the conservatives in Congress is doing is much higher. Approval for what Donald Trump is doing is much higher. And the Democrats are in the dumps right now. And now they're going to lose even more seats. And all they can do is say, well, we're going to keep trying to redraw all the rules and the boundaries until somehow we can pull a win out of this. That's crazy. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I want to ask you this question seriously. It has to do with the state of Washington. Should the rules allow state lawmakers, not just Democrats, but Democrats and Republicans, but should the rules allow lawmakers to do a Hillary Clinton with their computerized records? In other words, erase them. Except this is so crazy, you almost can't believe it, except this is coming from the Democrats. A new policy that was issued last week allows Washington state lawmakers to auto-delete their records within 30 days. Now, hold on. You're saying, so the records of how legislation gets made? An email provided to the Seattle Times, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper of Seattle, notified Democrats and Republicans 1 week before the change took place that happened on July 30th, so just about a week ago. It provides guidelines that most emails can be deleted immediately. A few of them have to be kept a bit longer. Under that rule, only the prime sponsors of legislation are required to retain emails that were sent to or from their office regarding those bills. If the member of the legislature is not the main sponsor of the bill, those emails are considered transitory and therefore can be deleted as soon as the member no longer needs or wants them. In other words, they're going to be able to erase all of the legislative history, or most of the legislative history, of how that bill got passed. That policy means that communications about legislation, including emails among lawmakers and from lobbyists, can be gone for good. That means that the public is going to have a tough time finding out, well, exactly who was it that was pushing that law? It allows lawmakers and aides to move emails into a folder that can be set to auto-delete after 30 days, provided that the lawmaker is not one of the prime sponsors of the bill in question. Bills get amended. Those amendments change the law, and they come from somewhere, and they're intended to do something for somebody. How do you find out who that somebody is? You take a look at some of the records. And now a brand new policy out of the Ferguson administration is going to allow lawmakers to simply erase their old emails. If that makes any sense to you, I'd be glad to hear why. By the way, today's Expo is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. And I hate the cost of gasoline just as much as all of you do. And I realize that most of the increase in the cost of gas in both Oregon and Washington is largely because of political decisions made by the folks elected to public office. On that note, Brett Davis joins me, who's the Pacific Northwest editor for the Center Square. Brett, welcome back.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
What in the world is going on with gas prices, and do you think we're going to get a realization by voters? This is what the majority of voters voted for in both Oregon and Washington.
Right. Well, there are several factors that go into gas prices in Washington, some more benign than others. For example, you know, there's a higher demand for gas in the summer simply because people travel more when the weather is nice. Related to that is a switch to a more expensive blend of gas formulated to reduce emissions during warmer months. But I think what you're getting at are things like the, and you mentioned it earlier, the cap and trade program that's part of the Climate Commitment Act. It's added, depending on who you ask, 40 to 50 cents to the cost of a gallon of gas. I'm sure you remember way back when our former governor tried to downplay that. Jay Inslee said it would cost pennies, which was sort of unusual, given that cap and trade, it's designed to increase gas prices by, you know, placing a cost on carbon emissions. And the whole program is built around reducing greenhouse gas emissions by, you know, requiring major polluters to produce carbon, to purchase carbon credits at carbon auctions. So it could, that's what it's designed to do. It's designed to increase gas prices. So to act like it's a surprise seems kind of odd.
Well, it also seems like an odd argument to say, if part of the purpose is to raise money for the carbon projects they're going to do, that's one thing.
Right.
But if you also say, like I think Obama said, that he wished gas was $8 a gallon because then people would use less of it. We found out when gas prices peaked at one point above $5 a gallon routinely that people really didn't reduce their driving that much at all. And the thing I'd ask you about the seasonal change, because it's summer and it's, you know, vacation season, if people are doing more driving, more trips to the river, more trips to the mountains, more trips to the beach. But do California's prices fluctuate that much? And California is a major car culture. You'd think that if the summer driving and the greater demand were going to drive up prices, we'd see that phenomena in almost any place in America, wouldn't we?
You would think so. I mean, this is an odd statistic, or I guess eye-opening, that Washington has the third highest average gas prices in the nation, behind California and Hawaii, for crying out loud. So that's a bit unusual.
Hawaii, you kind of understand it because almost everything has to get there by a barge,
right,
or be
flown imported.
And they're not flying gasoline to Hawaii yet, but I'm sure that's probably in the cards. But the other bits about the formulations, where they say, oh, we've got this special formulation. Do you happen to know how many different formulations of gas there are, say, in the United States? I think the number's around 100, isn't it?
I actually don't know off the top of my head, but I wouldn't be surprised if your estimate is accurate.
But that would be one thing that politicians could do. They could say, let's cut the number of formulations so we're making pretty much the same gas. And if you have some oddball places like Colorado, you know, at a mile high in Denver, okay, special gas for them. Everybody else uses the same kind of gas. That alone could bring the price down a bit.
You know, say everybody would be able to use the gas. They wouldn't have to have a special blend, you know, for each and every state, county, whatever.
Yeah, because I've literally been told that if you have, say, New York City, Manhattan ran low on gasoline for whatever reason, their supply got interrupted, and you say, but there are barges full of gas right over there in New Jersey. Manhattan is not allowed to use Jersey-formulated gas because those two states that are literally, you know, less than a mile apart have to use different kinds of gas. It's that kind of garbage that you'd think that the politicians would say, let's do it, except I have a feeling the same folks who wanted the Climate Commitment Act, Jay Inslee's special, say, no, we're happy when gas prices are high. We force people to use less.
It's like they want to have it both ways. You know, they know the price is going to go up, but then they complain when it does go up. It's like politics versus economics. They're not exactly the same thing.
No, and the other piece of this is you say, okay, so all this money they took in through the CCA, the Climate Commitment Act, that's brought in, I think, $3 or $4 billion.
$3.2 billion.
And so have they spent much of it at all on anything that actually makes the climate better?
I know our investigative reporter, T.J. Martinell, has written a few stories on this, and the answer seems to be no.
So, in other words, it's just another tax that buys more bureaucracy in Olympia, and that's about it, and costs more people to drive, and especially if they're driving to work. I mean, there are an awful lot of people listening to this show who drive to their job. A vehicle is part, and I don't mean just the Uber, you know, and the Grubhub and all those folks. I mean the folks who have to drive to construction sites or drive as a salesperson. Right. Those prices will just knock a hole in your pocket.
Right. I mean, I'm lucky I get to work from home, so I don't have to drive into the office, so to speak. But even when I go out and buy gas, I notice, you know, like not last weekend, but the weekend before, I almost filled up my car and it cost damn near $50. You know, I don't have to spend $50 or $60 every time I fill up my car, but that's the reality we live in right now. And I didn't even mention the gas taxes that went into effect at the beginning of July. I mean, the gas tax went up 6 cents per gallon from 49.4 cents to 55.4 cents, and it's only going to get worse. I mean, to adjust for inflation, they're going to rev it up 2% every year starting in July 2026. So, you know, buckle up. It's probably going to get worse.
Hey, I don't do a lot of math on the radio because, Brett, it's a bad idea. But my understanding is that the average gas producer, the folks who do the refining and all that, make about 8% of the sales price of gas. Now, obviously, the price includes taxes. But if you're selling gas at $4 a gallon and the oil company's making 8%, that means they're making 32 cents a gallon and the state of Washington is making 55 cents a gallon. At least the gas company did something for their 32 cents a gallon. The state of Washington does nothing and collects not quite twice as much money as the people who actually made the gas to begin with.
Right. I can see why you hate math.
But it's crazy. And yet I'm wondering, does any of this end up showing up when we go back to the polls and vote on who's going to be in charge in Olympia or in the various cities and counties around the state saying, if you raise the gas prices like that, I'm not voting you back into office, except I don't get the sense that the liberals will do that.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be the case in Washington state. We are true blue.
Yeah, and unfortunately, how do we get it to change? I guess you run the place up against a financial brick wall hard enough, and at some point things may change. But in California, they're going to be in the soup, and I think Oregon and Washington are going to suffer as well because California is about to see the shutdown in about a month or 2 months of one of their major refineries and another one in April of next year. And where are they going to get their gas? I have a feeling they're going to look to Washington, which has the only other refineries on the West Coast.
I think you might be right about that. And we see Governor Gavin Newsom of California backpedaling on this issue right now. So it's been interesting to see his flip-flop on this.
It is because is he going to be able to get Phillips, which has said we're going to shut down a major refinery? They're going to lose a third of their production. Now, if you take any commodity out there and you knock out a third of the production, we all know what's going to happen to the cost. The cost is going to go through the roof. And when they say, well, we'll just buy some from Washington State and then gas will become rarer in Oregon and Washington, Washington, and the price will go up here as well. Thank you very much, Gavin Newsom. Don't you dare run for president. That's Brett Davis, who is the Pacific Northwest editor of the Center Square. Back in a moment. We'll be right here on the Radio Northwest Network. And coming up, should we change the Amber Alert system to include abductor parents as well?
It's...
On demand, wherever and whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to talk about the Amber Alert system. Now, you hear about that from time to time. You hear that there's an Amber Alert out. Silver Alerts are for the seniors. Amber Alerts are for the kids. Except there's a whole somewhat complicated set of rules about when the police will issue an Amber Alert. And now there's a petition out there to try to change the Amber Alert system, at least as it applies in the state of Washington. They want to call it Whitney's Law that would ensure that alert systems include all at-risk kids, whether or not a parent is the abductor or not. And this all goes back to a terrible case involving Travis Decker, who allegedly killed Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia, his three young daughters. Their bodies were found dead a few days after they disappeared at a campground outside the town of Leavenworth, Washington. Great little town, but boy, this was a horrific case. The Wenatchee mother said that the girls were simply visiting their father on a scheduled visit. Then all four of them disappear. The three girls are found dead, and Travis Decker is on the run. So here's the question. Should they have issued an Amber Alert? Well, under the rules, they did not. And why? An Amber Alert was not issued for the Decker girls, even though they were overdue, even though the police were notified. They were simply a person who had not arrived on time. Authorities in the case said they didn't meet the criteria for an Amber Alert. Now, the U.S. Justice Department recommends this set of criteria be used for Amber Alert programs. Every single state has a slightly different system because the states have the right to make that decision. Let me get to the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our ex-poll question today, should members of Congress be expelled if they declare that their first loyalty is not to America, but to a foreign country? In this case, I'm talking about Democrat member of Congress Delia Ramirez, who is the daughter of illegal aliens, was brought to America as an unborn child. She was born in America to an illegal alien mother and father, who she says are now citizens. I suspect that because she arrived 3 years before the Congress passed the amnesty back in 1986, that her parents probably became citizens because of that amnesty. So they did not earn it the way most immigrants to America do, and that is by going through the process. Instead, it was a scam on America's Congress. Congress, the Democrats at least, had said, we're going to give amnesty to about 1 million illegal aliens at the time in 1986. In the end, it ended up being extended to a great number more than that because the courts kept extending it and extending it. And now we're hearing people, even some Republicans, who are suggesting, let's have another amnesty. Oh, yeah, because the last time we had an amnesty, it worked out so well. It didn't apply to 1 million. It applied to millions of illegals. And the next thing that happened was we got another flood of illegal aliens. And then, of course, the election, if you want to call it an election, of Joe Biden. And he opened up the borders and caused what even he called a border surge of literally millions of illegal aliens, 10 or 12 million of them over the 4 years of Joe Biden's tenancy in the Oval Office, because he wasn't actually calling the shots. He wasn't controlling the auto pen that signed all of his agreements. But in this case, you have Delia Ramirez, who told a conference in Mexico in Spanish, I am a proud Guatemalan before I am an American. I think by some interpretation, she's not an American. And I defend that by saying when she was born to her illegal alien parents, she would not have been an American under the 14th Amendment, because the 14th Amendment, and I've had a few people email, say, Lars, you're reading it wrong. No, there's a phrase in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution you really have to pay attention to. It is subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Now, what does that mean? It means that if you come to America as an immigrant and get a green card and you're going through the process to eventually become either a permanent resident alien in America or even an American citizen, your children are Americans. If, on the other hand, you sneak into our country or come in as a tourist or come in as a business person coming into America and then birth a child, that child is not an American citizen. So, if the Congress has a member like Delia Ramirez who says, I am a proud Guatemalan before I am an American, should that member be expelled? That's actually the suggestion of at least a couple of members of Congress, Republicans, who say, well, you probably ought to take her off her committees and consider taking some other actions against her as well. In any case, you can find the X-Poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Let me get back to the Amber Alerts. So, here's what the DOJ recommends. One, there must be a reasonable belief by law enforcement that an abduction has occurred. They're not saying that it was by a stranger. It could be a parent. The law enforcement agency believes the child is in imminent danger of serious bodily injury or even death. There is enough descriptive information about the victim and the abduction for law enforcement to issue an Amber Alert to try to help recover that child or children. The abduction is of a child age 17 years or younger. The child's name and other critical data elements, including the child abduction flag, have been entered into the NCIC system. That's the National Crime Information Center. And instead, law enforcement issued an endangered missing persons advisory for the Decker girls. Had an Amber Alert been issued, and this is Cairo News reporting it out of Seattle, a wireless emergency alert would have been automatically pushed out to millions of cell phone users asking people to keep an eye out for the girls and for their father. It was not. In fact, I remember the day that this happened when these girls disappeared, and I remember thinking, my cell phone didn't go off. I mean, occasionally, even here in the studio, my cell phone goes off with an Amber Alert or a Silver Alert. No such alert was sent out for the Decker girls. There is now an online petition that is addressed to the Washington State Police. It argues that the current Amber Alert standards are too narrow. Right now, the Amber Alert criteria excludes too many high-risk situations, especially involving non-stranger parental abductions. Even when a history of abuse or red flags are present, if the rules remain unchanged, we risk allowing more kids to fall through the cracks. Children who could be saved if only their cases were treated with the urgency that they actually deserve. And I think that would be a reasonable change to make. I'd be in favor. And if you need the link to the petition, send me an email, talk@LarsLarson.com. Let's go to Sean in Kelso. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I heard there was the watermelon that was so proud of her country. You know, when I take the citizenship, Lars, they put two flags. And that's a long time ago. But they say you give your flag down and put American flag up,
yep.
Which is what it is. I mean, I'm American. I'm not Mexican. I can care less if Mexico disappears tomorrow.
Yeah. Would you let Delia Ramirez stay in the U.S. Congress when she puts her first loyalty in Guatemala?
No, I don't like him. I don't like him. I don't like him one bit. But I don't know what we can do.
Well, public pressure is often really powerful, Sean. Because fact is, you know that when the public puts pressure on something, doesn't matter what the law is, public pressure alone might actually bring about some action. When it comes to Delia Ramirez, Guatemalan first, American second, and member of Congress and member of the Democrat Party. Sean, thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson Show. Snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've mentioned to you that Attorney General Pam Bondi has now announced that she's going to be taking evidence to a grand jury to hear about the Russiagate hoax. And I know that for some of you, you view this as old news. For me, this is more disturbing than even Watergate, where you have today the news and the documents of the last couple of weeks that Barack Obama and Joe Biden and members of the FBI, the CIA, and other government agencies participated in a hoax in an effort to try to change the outcome of the 2016 election. That is a completely serious issue, and it very much involves the survival of this country as a, you know, a constitutional republic. Dan Schneider joins me now, who's vice president at the Media Research Center's Free Speech America. Hey, Dan, welcome back to the program.
Lars, and you could not be more right. I mean, Watergate was about a sitting president using some campaign funds to hire some burglars to break into the DNC headquarters.
Yep.
This is about using our entire intelligence community, the FBI, all of these government resources to try to thwart the operation of a sitting president. I mean, this is a catastrophic thing for our nation. We've got to get to the bottom of it. I think Pam Bondi's going to get there.
Well, and the one thing that I get some skepticism from people, I'm one of those happy warriors who wakes up every day and goes, okay, I think we're going to get them now. If they're going to a grand jury and they're bringing evidence to the grand jury to say some of these people broke the law, whether it's Brennan, Clapper, I've heard from too many lawyers that say, well, Obama probably has immunity because he's a president. And I said, but doesn't he only have immunity for things that he did that are within the scope of his job as president, which does not include collusion or trying to change the next election? But they say he probably does have immunity. That's what the courts will do. Fine. Indict everybody around him. And one of the players is not from the government. It's a guy by the name of Leonard Bernardo, who worked as the senior vice president at George Soros' Open Society Foundation. How does he play into all of this?
Well, look, he plays in two different ways, because not only is he the senior vice president for George Soros, he's also a regular writer at the New York Times. So, you know, Lars, I read the New York Times piece that it's trying to dismiss the evidence, everything that Tulsi Gabbard has uncovered,
yep,
you know, through the disclosure of these things. And these New York Times writers are saying, well, we think that these emails are fake. They're not real. We don't think that Leonard Bernardo actually wrote these things. We just don't think that he did. Well, why didn't they just walk around the corner and ask him? The fact that they never bothered to ask. Lars, I know you well enough that if I saw an email that said purported to be written by you about me,
right,
I'd just call you up. Say, Lars,
well,
did you write this?
And by the way, if you're a federal agent and you come to me and said, Lars, did you write this email? I could say I'm going to talk to my lawyer first. But if you're a federal agent and I tell you a lie, then I've just committed another crime. I mean, you know, Martha Stewart went to prison for exactly that.
Right.
Not for stock trading, but because she lied to federal agents. So they could have asked Bernardo, did you write these? And if he says no, and then the FBI gets a subpoena, say, for the computer server data from the New York Times and says, well, we've now proved he did write the email. He told us he didn't. He's committed another crime. And he would know that. I would think he would know that going into the conversation. I've got to tell the FBI the truth. And they would have been able to get it straight from him and could have simultaneously subpoenaed records from all the other people who received that email and maybe where it was sent from. And if it was sent from the New York Times, subpoena them as well.
Yeah, but Hillary Clinton has not denied that any of this actually took place. Bernardo has not said it didn't happen. The people who are best positioned to know whether those emails are true, whether this conspiracy took place or not, have stayed silent. And you do have Brennan and Clapper who have said, oh, well, this is just ridiculous. But they don't deny it. They just say it's ridiculous.
No, and that's the funny thing is, Dan, you have to watch. It's almost like watching a movie script where you say, hold on. If you asked him if he did it and he said, well, that's ridiculous, he didn't say yes and he didn't say no. He said, that's ridiculous, which is a clever way to avoid saying yes or no, isn't it?
It's what in Washington, D.C., we call a non-denial denial. It suggests that he's denying it without actually denying it. And look, these guys are sophisticated D.C. people. I'm sure you've got some listeners who are saying, well, gee, Dan, you're kind of splitting hairs here.
Nope.
This is how D.C. talks. It's when you don't get the clear denial that here in D.C. we're going, yep, there's the admission by not actually denying it.
And frankly, the FBI or federal agents could drill in on it. We want to know, did you do this or not? We don't want to hear that's ridiculous or that's crazy or why would I ever do, I mean, all the other ways you have of non-denial denials. Yes or no, did you write this email? And if he wrote the email, I've read it to my audience. It's stunning in its implication.
It's stunning. Stunning. And by the way, Lars, you mentioned, you know, prosecutors could, you know, might be trying to do something here. And you mentioned Hillary Clinton or Martha Stewart, rather. Do you know which prosecutor decided to make his political bones by going after Martha Stewart?
Who is
James Comey?
James Comey.
James Comey was the lead prosecutor in that cooked up case where they went after Martha Stewart for essentially, you know, jaywalking. But she went to prison for 8 months because James Comey wanted to make a name for himself.
Yeah. And where was his daughter during the Epstein Ghislaine Maxwell trial? She was one of the prosecutors who didn't ask certain questions. I don't know whether she's dirty or not, but if daddy's dirty and the daughter didn't ask the obvious questions, I think a lot of this stuff ties together. So do you see with this grand jury being called, do Soros people get dragged into this as well as they should be?
Well, they have to, right? This guy, Leonard Bernardo, is going to have to testify before the grand jury whether he wrote that email, whether he was aware of what the FBI was doing, whether he was aware, as this email purports, that that Hillary Clinton had signed off on this. And by the way, this New York Times article that says, well, these emails are not accurate. Even these left-wing New York Times reporters who couldn't be bothered to go ask their colleague Bernardo, who also works at the Open Society Foundation, if it's true, their conclusion is that this so-called fake email is actually a combination of lots of other emails that the Russians got their hands on through Hillary Clinton's server. So the content is, I think the New York Times reporters are saying the content is true. It was just assembled in this one nice email by the Russians. That's their best argument. True, but it's a Christmas tree of different stories.
So the damning evidence came in. It just was assembled by somebody else. Well, to what end? You know, if I always thought that the Russians would have rather Hillary Clinton become president than keep. You know, there were lots of other reasons. They'd gotten along with her before. Trump is a tough character. Hillary wanted a reset with the Russians. Hillary would have guaranteed that America would pursue crazy energy schemes instead of drilling for oil and things like that. That was all good for Russia. I never understood why people thought that Russia really wanted Donald Trump and didn't want Hillary Clinton in there. And now we find out there's a possibly criminal conspiracy. So how soon do we think we get the subpoenas and the indictments?
Well, look, people need to be patient. Grand juries take time.
Yep.
And a big case gets developed over time. And I feel for my friends, Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, when people get upset and saying, why are they not moving faster? And look, to do things right, you have to get things buttoned up, tied up. It's really hard work.
Absolutely right. That's Dan Schneider. Dan is VP of the Media Research Center, Free Speech America. Dan, thanks very much for the time. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Hey, it's Lars.
You are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We provide honestly provocative talk. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. Our X poll today, if you'd like to cast a vote, should Congress expel a member who declares that their first loyalty is not to America, but is to a foreign country, in this case, Guatemala. That would be Democrat Representative Delia Ramirez, member of Congress from Illinois, who declared in Spanish to a conference in Mexico City, "I am a proud Guatemalan before I am an American." And already some of her Republican colleagues on Capitol Hill have said, why don't we just take her seat away from her? Why don't we take her off her Homeland Security Committee spot? And why don't we just tell her that you need to be loyal to America if you're going to serve the interests of your constituents who are in Illinois, which is in Chicago, Illinois, that you need to be loyal to them first and not to a foreign country, you know, in somewhere else in the world. That does not make sense. And yet that was what she said. She told a meeting of foreign Latinos in Mexico, "I am a proud Guatemalan before I am an American." The comments of a member of Congress. I would answer, should Congress expel them? Yes. Today's X poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, I want to tell you about a couple of things going on here in the Pacific Northwest. One of them, I could somewhat relate to this. There's a guy by the name of Sam Hawley. He owns a building in Ballard. Now, I can almost guarantee I have been to that building at a time or two, because it used to be the home of Joanne Fabric and Crafts. And I can tell you, as the husband of Tina Larson, I've been to, I think, every single Joanne store in the Pacific Northwest. And in fact, we were very disappointed that Joanne Fabric went out of business. I think probably driven out of business by competition from online like Amazon. But Sam Hawley owns the building and the land where the former Joanne Fabric store was. Well, the company went bankrupt. His tenant moved out at the end of April, and he secured the building. That wasn't good enough, because in June, he says 15 or 20 people moved into the parking lot of the building, and it was kind of like chaos. At the time, he said, we were in the process of installing a fence. The posts were up. The concrete was curing at that point. Como News reports, he said, the fencing wasn't up yet. Well, it turned out that people, like most of the homeless do, staying in that encampment generated a whole bunch of complaints among the neighbors, especially since they were openly using drugs right across the street from a children's playground at Ballard Commons Park. So Hawley called Seattle police. The officers came down. They gave trespass notices to the people who were staying illegally on the property. He then put $30,000 into a new perimeter fence, which is still being installed on the backside of the property. But already the city of Seattle had acted. Its city inspectors came down and gave him a notice that he was being fined because homeless people were occupying his property. He said it took time to line up the contractors to install the fence, repaint the building, to remove the graffiti. The city did not take that into consideration. I want to draw this picture for you, because this is where I think that government in the Northwest especially is going to create a war between citizens and the government. The government is there to serve the citizens, not the other way around. So when you have citizens like this guy, Sam Hawley, I don't know this guy personally. I feel sorry for him. I mean, he owns property. He pays taxes. He has a right to expect service from the government. And he goes to the city of Seattle and says, hey, there are these people who've taken over my property. They're occupying my property. And they say, well, that's too bad, but you let graffiti be put on the property. He didn't let it. People did it. How in the world does a property owner keep people from putting graffiti vandalism all over a property? He goes out and has to spend a lot of money to try to protect his property, which should be under the protection of the city of Seattle. Instead, they turn around and say, hey, your building looks ugly. It's got graffiti all over it. Here's a fine. and they've begun fining him hundreds, I don't know if it's added up to thousands yet, but hundreds of dollars. Hawley says it would have been nice to have a little grace period. Apparently, the city of Seattle does not believe in that. Second issue that I want to put in front of you, and that is this. Oregon has a very generous public pension system known as PERS. Well, apparently their investment record is not exactly anything to write home about. The Oregon Journalism Project, that's Mark Zussman, Nigel Jaquis, a number of great investigators, they've been doing some good stories. And what have they turned out to find out? They have an investment officer who's been with the state since 2020. He oversees $100 billion in that pension fund and how they invest it. And one of the ways they invest it is what is known as private equity. That's where you're not buying stocks or bonds or things like that. You take the money, you invest it in buildings, in companies, and that sort of thing, and then you resell them 7 to 10 years from now, and hopefully you make some money. Problem is, their benchmark for making money, well, it's the Russell 3000 benchmark, which had a yield of 38%. Yeah, what were they making? About 4%. So they invested badly, and yet Rex Kim, the Treasury's chief investment officer, he still pulled down $810,000. It makes him the highest paid state employee. They made bad investments, but they still got their paychecks. You've got the Lars Larson.